This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, May 24th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, federal and local officials put pressure on BP to step up its response to the oil disaster in the Gulf. We'll take a look at a community effort to monitor damage from the spill. In D.C., the Senate takes up a multi-billion dollar war spending bill. And we'll go to Haiti to visit the capital's only public hospital as it struggles to keep up with the needs of patients. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court today agreed to consider the civil rights of death row inmates with respect to DNA testing of evidence. In a case that may have broad implications, the court will consider the possibility that federal civil rights law may allow Henry Skinner to gain access to DNA testing of evidence that was not done during his trial, but that may well exonerate him of the 1993 Texas murder of his girlfriend and her two children. In the past, the court has said that convicted criminals do not have the right to demand DNA testing, but this is the first case that considers a death row inmate trying to save his life. For the second week in a row, arrests in New York City call attention to comprehensive immigration reform. FSRN's Renee Feltz has more.
Last Monday, 16 people calling for immigration reform were arrested for blocking a busy street in front of New York City's Federal Plaza. That number more than doubled today when 37 people were handcuffed and loaded into a police van. They included members of New York City Council, State Assembly, as well as union leaders and clergy members.
We believe immigration is a civil rights issue of the 21st century.
Bishop Orlando Finlater was among those arrested. He's the leader of a coalition of 140 Caribbean churches that have undocumented immigrants in their congregations.
We have written letters, we have marched, we have rallied, and we have seen no real action. And so it's our intention to step up.
Renee Feltz, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
Violence spread in Jamaica today, where heavily armed police patrolled the streets of Kingston and locals blocked a bridge that links the capital city with Montego Bay. Unrest began last week after Jamaica agreed to extradite an alleged drug kingpin. But Christopher Koch's supporters say he's a legitimate businessman and have taken up arms to defend him. Today, Koch said he would not surrender. Two police officers are dead, at least six others injured. A state of emergency was imposed last night. According to U.S. Drug Enforcement officials, Koch is accused of running a violent gang called the Shower Posse that sells drugs in the U.S. and sends him the profits. A U.N.-sponsored summer camp in Gaza was set ablaze today following warnings over the weekend from imams. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
The blaze completely devastated one of the summer camps the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, is setting up in Gaza. Over the weekend, imams at various Gaza mosques warned that the UN agency's co-ed camps create values that contradict the conservative nature of Gaza society by bringing both boys and girls together. Local community groups say the fire will affect the children's summer activities just at a time the kids of Gaza need such recreational programs. They call on the Hamas-led government to immediately bring to justice those behind the attack. For the second year in a row, the UNRWA is organizing summer programs in many parts of the region. They hope to provide the kids in Gaza an opportunity to find fun again after the violence of the January 2009 Israeli incursion. The project covers all elementary and preparatory UN-run schools. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
In Japan, at least 70 detainees in the Yoshiku Immigration Detention Center northeast of Tokyo have been on hunger strike for more than 13 days. FSRN's Claudia Craig has more.
The hunger strikers, many of them Sri Lankans and Pakistanis, are refugees who came to Japan looking for work. Apart from the unexplained death of an African inmate, they also want to bring to the world's attention the suicides in the center of a Brazilian and South Korean detainee. Back in March, Jorge Bustamante, a UN human rights envoy, raised serious concerns about Japan's often years-long detentions of undocumented migrants, including parents with children, as well as rejected asylum seekers. Claudia Craig, FSRN.
Also from Japan, Prime Minister Yukio Hatoyama did an about-face and said due to the political climate in the Koreas, he's decided to make good on an agreement with the U.S. and move the Futenma Air Force Base to another location on the island. South Korea officially cut trade ties with the North today and banned Pyongyang's ships from South Korean waters. The moves come as a result of the sinking of a South Korean warship. 46 sailors were killed. Both the U.S. and the U.N. expressed support for South Korea. And in Chicago, proceedings began in the trial of a former police officer accused of covering up past torture of suspects. Lieutenant John Burge has pleaded not guilty to obstruction of justice and perjury during a civil trial on charges that he was responsible for torturing suspects throughout the 1970s and 80s. He's not charged with torture because the statute of limitations has run out. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Federal officials visited the Gulf of Mexico today to monitor BP's response to the ongoing oil spill in the region. The oil company has come under increasing criticism from local communities and public officials for what they say is a slow and inadequate response to the disaster. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano pledged to hold BP accountable for the cleanup.
We are going to do everything we can to protect these lands, protect these parishes, and to make sure that claims are paid, the oil well is sealed, and this area comes back.
Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal emerged from a meeting with Secretary Napolitano and Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar, describing it as good, direct, frank talks. Over the weekend, Jindal criticized the federal government and BP for being slow to lay down protective booms and to dispatch vessels to combat the spill. So far, more than 65 miles of Louisiana's shoreline have been affected by the oil.
For anyone who has seen this damage or seen the impact of this oil firsthand, you know that what we've been saying is true. This oil threatens not only our coast and our wetlands, this oil fundamentally threatens our way of life here in South Louisiana.
Now, a grassroots effort is being organized to independently monitor the spill. Local residents are using interactive mapping to document the damage. To learn more, we're joined by Mariko Toyoji, a research associate with the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. She joins us from New Orleans. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, thank you.
Your organization has created a map that documents the effects of this oil spill, but it draws on input from community members and residents. How does the map work?
So the way the map works is that people along the Gulf Coast that are affected by the oil spill can either report in via text message, email, Twitter, or file a report on the website itself. And what happens with this information is that it's populated on a web-based map that's open and public information. And so it's fantastic because it's information that's coordinated, it's accessible, and it's participatory too.
And when it goes online, what does it look like? What do people who go to the website have access to?
What they have access to are these sort of bubbles. And these bubbles indicate where reports have been made. If you click on the bubble, what shows up, it tells you how many reports. And then by clicking, there's more information as you go through. So you can look at individual reports. You can look also at categories of types of reports, whether it's odor, affected wildlife, oil on shore. You can separate out that information and it will show up on a populated map.
Well, for example, I went to the map a little while ago and there's a posting from an out-of-work oyster fisherman from today who writes, mm-hmm. quote, cannot work with BP either after being admitted to the hospital for low oxygen intake after smelling heavy oil and chemical fumes for the last week in both Boras and Venice, that's in Louisiana. What happens next with this kind of information?
So this is information, normally it would not get out to the public at all. This information normally gets buried, it gets hidden, there's no way to access it. Now that it's available, we can see that these effects are coming, and if we see more effects, it points to a pattern and a pattern of concern. We have right now the Louisiana Public Health Institute. They took interest in the map after seeing lots of reports of people complaining of odors, dizziness, nausea, headache. And so the thing about this map is that with every report that comes in, each individual report becomes more powerful and more important.
Mariko Toyoji, there have been concerns raised about conflict of interest in the monitoring of the damage from this disaster. Last week, the New York Times reported that federal officials were telling volunteers who were collecting these samples that they had to send them to a laboratory and a company hired by BP, since these same samples could be used later in determining the extent of the damage and if BP is liable or responsible. Some scientists are raising the issue of a conflict of interest. Talk about the importance of creating an independent documentation of the damages and how this could be used in the future.
What we're trying to do with this map, as far as regards to transparency, is that we want to hold BP accountable in a way that information coming from the people can be documented to show the magnitude and impact of the spill that's independent of BP control. Right now, if you want to talk to the Coast Guard or the EPA regarding the spill, you have to go through BP, and it just gets lost in sort of this chain of bureaucracy. And so this is a way for people to document and utilize this tool as a way to show what's happening and what's going on from the ground. And so we're hoping that this can be used as a way to monitor the effects of the spill, both environmentally and potentially for litigation in the future.
Mariko Toyoji is a research associate with the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. She joined us to talk about community efforts to document the oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Thank you for speaking with us.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
And you can find a link to the map and info on how to contribute to it on our website, fsrn.org. In Washington, the Senate moves from the major domestic policy of reforming the financial industry to foreign policy. This week, it will take up a $33.5 billion war spending bill. As FSRN's Leon Caldwell reports, some Democrats are wary of supporting President Obama's war policy.
On Saturday, the president delivered a commencement address at West Point Military Academy. He outlined a vision of international cooperation, with a stark assessment that a nearly decade-long war persists.
Cadets, there will be difficult days ahead. We will adapt, we will persist, and I have no doubt that together with our Afghan and international partners, we will succeed in Afghanistan.
That reality is evident to many West Point cadets. It will become more apparent to Congress this week as a debate looms over additional funding for the war. The Senate is taking up a $33 billion funding bill, mostly for the war in Afghanistan. The money would pay for the additional 30,000 troops for the remainder of the year. This, as President Obama promised to end supplemental war funding, but he sent another one to Congress. The spending measure is outside the normal budget process. Therefore, it's put on the country's credit card to be paid back later. It's how most of the $1 trillion used for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been supplied. Tom Andrews is a former member of Congress from Maine and current president of the Win Without War Coalition.
Another year, another supplemental, another emergency funding of a war 9 years in. It's, you know, incredible that Congress can still look at all of us with a straight face and say, geez, we had no idea that we were going to need to have a supplemental appropriation for this war that we, of course, had no idea was going to happen. But here we are 9 years in and nine supplementals.
While fiscal conservatives have been objecting to spending for the stimulus and health care, they usually support war. But one fiscal hawk, Republican Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, says this time's going to be different. He wants this spending bill to be paid for. He threatened to block it until Democrats figure out a way to do it. Meanwhile, liberal Democrats have opposed war funding in the past, citing their objection to the wars. Democratic Representative Alan Grayson of Florida is focused on next year's war spending. The president requested $159 million for 2011. Grayson calls on President Obama to pay for the wars with the $500 billion defense budget. Grayson spoke on the House floor.
It's simply not necessary. You can see for yourself. Enough is enough. $549 billion is plenty, particularly when we're using the Chinese credit card to pay for it all.
Grayson's proposal would use the war funding to excuse the first $35,000 of income from taxes. And Senator Russ Feingold hopes to force the president to submit a concrete timeline for a U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. It's unclear yet if he will receive a vote on his measure. Senate leadership hopes to pass the supplemental before Memorial Day. The House would need to pass it before the president can sign it. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The federal budget has come into effect in Canada, but now many Aboriginal organizations are unhappy with some key funding decisions. They say some cuts could eliminate vital programs for the community, including health and healing services. Aaron Lakoff has the story from Montreal.
Aboriginal health groups across Canada will be struggling to stay alive this summer. In the official budget released last March, the Canadian federal government announced a discontinuation of funding for the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, or the AHF. The umbrella organization provides financial resources to 134 different community projects across the country, including the Native Friendship Center of Quebec City and the Toronto Native Cultural Center. Their funded projects are focused on culturally appropriate healing methods for Aboriginal communities suffering from violence. Wayne Spear is the director of communications for the AHF.
Most of the projects we fund use a combination of traditional Aboriginal activities and cultural ceremonies, and then Western therapeutic methods, so talking to a trained therapist, a counselor.
Many organizations are now faced with a threat of closing down, including Native women's shelters and mental health services. The Canadian 2010 budget did announce nearly $200 million in funding for mental and emotional support services through Health Canada. This money will be for services offered to the general Canadian population, but will not provide for specific health services for Indigenous communities. Indigenous leaders argue that Native communities require traditional healing treatments which are not offered by Health Canada. Again, Wayne Spear.
What we've been saying is that the Aboriginal Healing Foundation is a specific and unique funding model. We support Aboriginal-developed, Aboriginal-managed, community-based projects. So the things that are being done in the community to address the legacy of physical and sexual abuse were developed locally to serve the needs of a local population. That this is a unique model, and it's developing capacity in the community, and it's empowering people.
During an emergency debate in Parliament on the issue on March 30th, Minister of Indian Affairs Chuck Strahl argued that the organization was set up with a time-limited mandate, and this was the justification for not renewing its funding. Strahl also highlighted the fact that the Canadian government will continue to fund residential school survivor programs outside the AHF. However, Aboriginal rights activists charge that the non-renewal of funding on the part of the government is hypocritical given their official apology in 2008 for Canada's residential school policy. The residential school system was an official Canadian government policy between 1892 and 1969, whereby Native children were forcibly taken away from their families and institutionalized in hostels, industrial schools, and residential schools for the purposes of Christianization and assimilation. Instances of physical and sexual assault were widespread in the system, and many survivors are still coping with the after effects until this day. Maya Robanganey is an activist in Montreal who has been working to raise awareness around the funding challenges for Aboriginal organizations.
The residential school apology was what many saw as an indication that the government was going to actually take steps to not just apologize with words, but actually take steps to like right the wrongs, so to speak. But cutting the Aboriginal Healing Foundation is like the exact opposite thing that the government should be doing.
On March 29th, as a response to these funding decisions, a group of six women held a peaceful sit-in just outside Minister Strahl's office in Ottawa. Their action lasted an hour and a half before they were all arrested. Amy Liu was one of the women arrested at the minister's office, and over the last week, she's been engaged in a campaign of lobbying and phone calls to politicians with the hopes of restoring the AHF's funding.
The neglect and the disregard for Indigenous people in this country is appalling, and it's constant. It's not a shock that these funding cuts have taken place, and it's one more step to ignoring the issue at hand.
If no other outside funding is found, the Aboriginal Healing Foundation will completely close its doors in 2012. Until then, they will continue to operate 12 healing centers across the country, a drastic reduction from before the budget cuts. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
A Caribbean storm system is dumping heavy rains on Port-au-Prince as hundreds of thousands remain homeless 4 months after the devastating earthquake in Haiti. Despite fears to the contrary, relief agencies have not reported mass outbreaks of contagious diseases among the thousands of displaced families living in squalid camps. Haiti's health system has benefited from an influx of foreign money and resources, but it's still not enough for many who fall ill. FSRN's Ansel Hurst takes us inside Port-au-Prince's only public hospital, the State University Hospital of Haiti, to examine what the country's public healthcare system is like today.
Patients and doctors alike are filling up water bottles in the sweltering heat of the general hospital's courtyard. The hospital's water treatment system malfunctioned before the quake. Now pipes and faucets set up in two places supply potable water fresh from the spigot.
If the standard is the United States, extremely below standard. If the standard is Haiti pre-quake, it's above standard. Things are a lot better now than they were, but there's still a lot of room for improvement.
Eric Lutz is a project manager for Operation Blessing, an American aid group that installed the new water system and is repairing the hospital's water wells. He worked at the hospital before the quake.
You know, there's a lot of organizations that will come in and they will say, this is what we're doing. You know, for your hospital, this is what we're going to do. But Operation Blessing, we try to do things a little different. We come in and we meet with Dr. Lustig, Madam Thompson. We say, how can we be of benefit to the hospital? And so they came to us with a proactive list of things that need to be done. And we've just kind of one by one been trying to take care of the list. So,
a gleaming ambulance sits near the gate. It's one of two new donated emergency vehicles. The hospital had none before the quake to serve Port-au-Prince's population of nearly 3 million people. A lot has changed at the General Hospital since the quake. Hundreds of nurses died when their building collapsed on top of them. But an influx of equipment, volunteer international staff, and free services has improved the level of care available to patients. But it's not enough. At the hospital's entrance, there are no signs or staff offering directions, just a gate that opens into the courtyard. Individuals who appear to be patients stand or crouch in corners of the compound, some on crutches. One elderly man vomits, another is washing laundry. 73-year-old Lucille Cherry huddles with three other women under a patch of shade.
I have problems with my eyes. I came here a long time ago, but they haven't cared for me. I saw a doctor once. They gave me medications for free, but that's over now. Now I'm supposed to buy it outside of the hospital.
Cherie says she can't afford her medicine, which costs about $4, but hopes somebody will lend her money. About 50 people have lined up for blood tests out of a tented laboratory. Some say they have been turned away and told to return another day multiple times. Volunteers from Partners in Health occupy a small ward near the General Hospital's entrance. Haitian nurse Albette Duvreau came from New York 3 weeks ago to work long shifts into the night.
I hope the government does its best to improve the situation for the patients here, because there have to be changes. For example, the patients have no privacy. Normally, it shouldn't be this way. Women shouldn't be mixed with men. I've worked in hospitals in the States. There's such a gap. No materials, no medicines.
Her sister, Looney, also a nurse, came from California. Looney says she sees two or three children die almost every day in the pediatric ward from preventable diseases like malaria. When FSRN visited the General Hospital last fall, it seemed largely deserted. Patients were charged for everything, from needles, medication, to lab tests. Hospital Director Dr. Alix Lasseg says the facility treats nearly 1,000 people per day.
And that's the Ministry of Health that gives me free medication, medical supplies, other auxiliary things. And they told me that that will be the case until July. After that, I don't know.
Several private hospitals and clinics in Port-au-Prince have reportedly closed shop because of the wealth of free care available to the sick following the tremors. But Lasseg says he's submitting a budget proposal asking the government to continue supporting the hospital's free services policy. In its $10 billion request for reconstruction funds to the international community, the Haitian government asks for $390 million for its healthcare system. It wants to rebuild 30 of 49 hospitals in the quake-affected regions and construct 8 new hospitals in the outlying provinces. Special mention is made of the need to recapitalize the private health sector. For now, international aid continues to flow, allowing Haitians to access a quality of health care often considered inaccessible before the quake. But how much longer it will be available is a lingering question. Ansel Hers with Fendi Janvier, FSRN, Port-au-Prince.
Also in Haiti, the UN has launched an investigation into the deaths of dozens of inmates who were killed at a jail during a riot that took place after the January earthquake. The New York Times reported over the weekend that at least 12 unarmed prisoners were killed by Haitian police in the incident. The police had said that fighting among inmates caused the deaths, but evidence and accounts from witnesses inside the jail dispute this. Today marks the 30th anniversary of the start of the organization known as Food Not Bombs. Celebrations took place over the weekend in several cities around the world, including Boston, where the original chapter has been working continuously for 3 decades. Chuck Rosina files this report.
You can also check out the next couple of workshops, which are Composting, Remediating Urban Soil for Food Security by Andrew. He's a farmer and Food Not Bombs activist. Or Homeless Issues, which is a meeting between various members of Boston's homeless community for public observance.
The Boston Common was humming with activity Sunday for the Food Not Bombs 30th anniversary celebration. Food Not Bombs is a worldwide all-volunteer organization serving up free vegetarian meals made with food discarded by supermarkets and restaurants. Keith McHenry is one of the Food Not Bombs co-founders.
We started in Cambridge 30 years ago. We kind of marked the May 24th occupation attempt of Seabrook Nuclear Power Station, where Brian Feigenbaum, one of the other 8 people that started it, was arrested. And we mark it that day because then that's when we started doing the actions to support his legal defense.
Food Not Bombs initially provided free meals at protests, but later expanded their activities to feeding the homeless and anyone else wanting a free meal. A woman nicknamed Home Fries describes what motivated her to begin volunteering with Food Not Bombs more than 10 years ago.
Food distribution is something that happens in a much more institutional context, like in a soup kitchen or in a food pantry or the food bank kind of way. When I heard about people just taking it upon themselves to make sandwiches and give them out or make soup or stew or whatever, I thought, wow, that's so obvious. Of course I should do that. Of course that should be happening, and of course that's something I should help out with.
Food Not Bombs co-founder Keith McHenry moved to San Francisco in 1987 and started the chapter there. Police actions against the organization's volunteers called attention to their activism, and the concept began to spread to other cities. Today, according to Keith McHenry, Food Not Bombs has over 1,000 chapters on 6 continents. All are independently run by volunteers who operate under the principle of food as a human right. Alicia is one of the organizers of this Boston Common event.
Due to the anti-capitalist nature of Food Not Bombs, which sees capitalism as the root of so many struggles of people being homeless and having food insecurity, they go out there every week and serve 2 meals.
To see a timeline of the 30-year history, visit foodnotbombs.net. From the Boston Common, I am Chuck Rosina for Free Speech Radio News.
Food Not Bombs, 30 years of direct nonviolent anarchist action to feed the people on the streets. Not too shabby.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Shannon Young. Today's headlines editor was Nell Abram. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at FSRN.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments at FSRN.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doreen Marina.